third lecture in our American Conversation series. This year's series is on the theme of cultural politics, political culture. For those of you who don't know me, but I don't know if there is anybody. Now I can't read. I'm Nina Silber. I'm the director of the American Studies program here. So far in this series on cultural politics and political culture, we have addressed topics such as the 20th century left and homosexuality, and then the problem of post-Civil War sectionalism as reflected in the federal archives. Today, we are honored to have with us Professor Amanda Kleibaugh, professor of English at Harvard University. Professor Kleibaugh is the author of numerous works that deal with such topics as marriage law and Jude the Obscure, Mark Twain's Civil War writings. As I was telling her before, an essay that I'm definitely going to make a point of reading as soon as possible on the Civil War novelist John DeForest's career as a bureaucratic administrator titled Bureaucracy in America, because I feel that anybody who can mesh the Civil War with administrating is a person after my own heart. Of course, she is also the author of the 2007 book, The Novel of Purpose, Literature and Social Reform in the Anglo-American World, which considers the interplay of 19th century social reform and literary works in a transatlantic context. This book won the prize for best first book in Victorian studies. And she's currently working on a lot of things, I think, but so you could say more. I mean, I noticed that you're working on a book called The Southern, the Western, and Washington, D.C., which is going to be an examination of regional writings as a way to understand the origins of our current thinking about the federal government. And today, she's addressing this topic, Famous Men of the Negro Race, African American Literature, and the Problem of Reconstruction. So please help me welcome Amanda Kleibaugh.
So I just want to say I'm so happy to be here, in part because it's nice to see so many of you whom I usually see at the Mahindra Center here, and also because this thing I'm presenting to you is very much a work in progress. It's something I've been thinking about off and on over the past few years, and I haven't yet found the right form to make this argument. And so this is my latest attempt. And I say all of this to say that more than would be even usually the case, I would really welcome stringent feedback. This is something I'm struggling with, and I need your help. And from the people I know and from the people I've met, this seems like actually the perfect audience to think about this set of problems with. So I'm delighted to be here. I just have to get accustomed to my PowerPoint again. Okay. At the turn of the 20th century, a new generation of African-American authors came into its own. It was a remarkably varied group, including Charles Chestnut, Paul Laurence Dunbar, and Pauline E. Hopkins, as well as authors who remain less well-known, among them Anna Julia Cooper, David Bryant Fulton, and Sutton E. Griggs. It also embraced the late work of an author from an earlier generation, Francis E.W. Harper. Now, these men and women wrote in a variety of genres. They wrote essays as well as poems and novels, and they wrote in an array of modes. They were realists, they were sentimentalists, they wrote utopias, detective fiction, science fiction, all kinds of things. And they published in an array of venues. Some published their works in the major Northeastern magazines, while others helped to create and sustain specifically African-American journals. And still others sold their works door to door by subscription or tried to smuggle their texts into the letters columns of local newspapers. So what unites all of these disparate figures? Kenneth Warren would say Jim Crow. And so before I go on, actually, I'm interested in how many of you, I know that you, but how many other people in the audience are aware of this argument about Ken Warren and what was, okay, because this talk is oriented toward that argument. And so I'm happy to kind of fill in the context for people who are less familiar. In Warren's recent attempt to reperiodize American literature, he argues that while African-American men and women have certainly always written literary works from the earliest arrival in the North American continent, and while they will certainly always continue to write literary works into any future we can possibly imagine, there's nonetheless something distinctive about one period of their writing, the period that extends from the establishing of Jim Crow in the late 1890s to the dismantling of that regime in the 1960s. The literature of this period is a Jim Crow literature in two senses of the term. It is first a segregated literature, avowedly African-American in contrast to earlier and later periods which understood themselves, according to Warren, instead as part of other traditions, whether those traditions be universalist or American, multicultural, or transnational. Jim Crow, that is to say, created a kind of colored car in the literary sphere. But this is a Jim Crow literature in a second sense as well. It is at all times shaped by the project of bringing Jim Crow to an end. Many of these authors writing during these years deliberately committed themselves and their writings to the struggle against Jim Crow. They wrote, to use Warren's terms, instrumentally. Other authors, by contrast, sought to evade the political and write instead for purely artistic reasons, but their works were inevitably recruited back into the struggle against Jim Crow, their literary achievements used, in Warren's term, indexically, to demonstrate the accomplishments of the race. For Jim Crow differed, Warren emphasizes, from other systems of racial oppression in its totalizing claims about race. A state-sponsored racial caste system, it enclosed every African-American man and woman, making any of their actions necessarily a blow for equality. So that's the Warren argument. Warren does not discuss any of the authors I've just named, except for a single brief reference to Sutton E. Griggs, but they clearly fall within the period he's describing. They are all, with the exception of Harper, writing after Jim Crow was upheld by the 1896 Supreme Court decision Plessy v. Ferguson. And even Harper, writing a few years earlier than Plessy, is aware of the segregation regime that is consolidating around her. Moreover, these authors all write against that regime. Most often they do so instrumentally. They make speeches, they publish political essays, and they write novels depicting violence at the polls, short stories depicting the humiliations of the colored car, and poems apostrophizing the trees from which the lynched are hung. And when some of these authors aspire to more purely artistic ends, they are well aware that their work will be taken as an index of African-American achievement more generally. So thus far, Warren's paradigm accounts perfectly for the authors I'll be discussing. But there are moments in each of their texts that function neither instrumentally nor indexically, moments that trouble and unsettle the political work that these texts are otherwise trying to do, moments that can only be explained by a different paradigm. And these moments all have something to do with Reconstruction. Reconstruction is a central topic for these authors, in part because it shaped many of their lives in ways I'll illuminate in a second, but also because they were well aware of something that we have tended to forget, that the Jim Crow regime couldn't be established until the last vestiges of Reconstruction were decisively erased. So Reconstruction had ended, of course, much earlier, throughout the 1870s, as the Southern states, one by one, replaced their radical Republican governments with conservative Democratic ones, a process that came to be called redemption. Redemption happened peacefully in those states where conservative voters outnumbered radicals. As soon as former Confederates were reenfranchised, they had the power simply to vote the radicals out, and they did so throughout the early 1870s. In states with radical majorities, however, in states like Louisiana, Mississippi, and South Carolina, the radicals couldn't be voted out. And so the Redeemers turned to propaganda and to violence. The propaganda began in the mid-1870s as the Northern press, which had thus far supported the radicals, began to publish increasingly virulent attacks on Reconstruction. These attacks discredited Reconstruction by creating the figure of the corrupt carpetbagger, the venal scalawag, and worst of all, the ignorant African-American voter and the incompetent African-American officeholder. The remaining radical state governments came to be associated with officeholders who were described in the Northern press as speaking a grandiloquent and nonsensical rhetoric when they weren't grunting an incomprehensible dialect, as slavishly following the will of their carpetbagger masters when they weren't pursuing their own cunning schemes of securing money and drink, peanuts, fried chicken, and white women. Now, there's an endless array of pictures and anecdotes about this, which I will forbear from showing to you, because in the end, it's just like an array of racist images. Violence soon followed, and in the mid to late 1870s, Southern elections were disrupted by white insurgencies, and African-American voters were intimidated by acts of terrorist violence. The violence was open and unapologetic, but the federal government was no longer willing to intervene to stop it, persuaded by the propaganda campaign that the radical state government were not worth defending. Now, as soon as they had redeemed a Southern state, conservatives simply ignored the provisions of Reconstruction. The 15th Amendment was still in effect. African American men retained the right to vote and hold office. But nearly everywhere in the South, they were prohibited from doing so by poll taxes, literacy requirements, and grandfather clauses, by intimidation, by fraud. But in the 1890s, a new generation of conservative leaders found even this state of affairs intolerable. They wanted to make what had been a de facto disfranchisement de jure, and they understood the project of doing so specifically as rolling back Reconstruction. For this reason, the historian Michael Perman has called the turn of the 20th century the era of restoration, the period when the South was restored to what it had been just after the Civil War had ended and just before Reconstruction began, the moment when African Americans had natural rights to liberty, but not much else. The restoration campaign took place in state legislatures, where constitutions were amended to disfranchise African American voters, and it was sustained, as the redemption campaign had been, by propaganda and by violence. There was another round of white insurgencies targeting the few southern districts where African Americans continued to vote. There was a terrorizing rise in lynching, and there were also new critiques of Reconstruction, critiques that could be found in venues both high and low. In the Atlantic Monthly, for instance, historians soberly debated whether Reconstruction had been malicious or merely misguided, a debate that would continue to dominate the historiography for the next 60 years, while novels like The Klansman and films like Birth of a Nation would fix images of corrupt carpetbaggers, venal scalawags, and brutish African-American office holders firmly in the American imagination. Now, it was in this discursive context that the authors I'm focusing on came into their own, and as we would expect, they defended Reconstruction as vigorously as they had battled Jim Crow. Or at least, they defended it in their non-fictional writings. In their fictional writings, by contrast, Reconstruction deranges, interrupting the otherwise smooth workings of these otherwise clearly and familiarly instrumental texts. Recognizing the deranging effect of Reconstruction is the first step, I think, in developing an alternate paradigm for understanding African American literature, one that supplements Warren's by giving a quite different account of activism, the state, and the course of African American history. And so in what follows, I'll offer three brief case studies of the three best-known authors of this period, that's Harper, Chestnut, and Hopkins, and then I'll go on to elaborate briefly what I take to be the broader significance of Reconstruction for African American authors more generally. So we start with Harper. One of the most famous reformers in the 19th century, Frances E.W. Harper entered public life in the 1850s through her work on the anti-slavery campaign. Active in the Underground Railroad, she also served as a traveling lecturer for various anti-slavery societies, speaking in towns across New England and in the Great Lakes regions as well. After slavery was abolished, Harper threw herself into the work of Reconstruction. She spent much of her time between 1867 and 1871 touring the southern states, famously visiting all of them but Arkansas and Texas, and returning north only to attend women's suffrage conventions. She gave speeches everywhere she went, often one or two even a day, as well as engaging in impromptu debates with planters she encountered in the railroad cars. In her nonfictional writings, Harper makes her views of Reconstruction clear. She celebrates the extension of suffrage to African American men. She argues that suffrage should be extended as well to women. And she emphasizes that suffrage alone is not enough for either sex unless it is supplemented by the kind of moral training that ensures that the vote is exercised in the service of the proper end. So in essence, she believes that Reconstruction is fine, but it's in need of supplementation by traditional 19th century social reform. And so while Harper celebrates in a May 1867 letter the fact that the colored man gets his freedom and suffrage together, she warns in a letter written in July of the same year that suffrage alone is not enough. "While I am in favor of universal suffrage," she writes, "yet I know that the colored man needs something more than a vote in his hand. What he needs," she goes on to explain, "are the values of home, family, and independent labor, values that Harper sought to instill through her reformist work." Now, in Harper's Reconstruction era fiction, these views are reproduced precisely. Harper published several works of fiction and two volumes of poetry during Reconstruction, but I'll take a look just at two of them, Minnie's Sacrifice, a short novel of 1869, and Sketches from the South, a series of poems from 1872. Both of these works offer generally favorable accounts of Reconstruction, interspersed with criticisms that are intended to shape its further course. So Minnie's Sacrifice recounts what would become the central narrative of Harper's career, the story of racial choosing, in which a privileged person is faced with the choice of whether to align him or herself with an oppressed race. It focuses on two protagonists, Louis and Minnie, both of whom have been brought up as white and learn only when they are adults that their mothers had actually been slaves. They choose to cast their lot in with their mother's race and go south in the immediate aftermath of the Civil War to help uplift that race, Louis by becoming involved in local politics, and Minnie by teaching in a freedman's school. So you see the marriage of politics and reform. Even as Minnie instills in her students the values that Harper would have new voters learn, she also asks why the Negro's hour is not the Negro woman's hour also, and she goes on to argue that government needs a woman's conscience as well as a man's judgment. So if Minnie's Sacrifice makes the case for female suffrage through hortatory calls, Sketches from the South makes the same case through astringent critique. The critique comes in the so-called Aunt Chloe poems, a series of six poems that unfold the sweep of 19th century history within the story of a single family and recount that story in a freed woman's vernacular voice. In the first poem, Aunt Chloe narrates the sale of her sons, and in the last, their eventual return to her as grown men. In between come poems that focus on national events. The longest of these poems, The Deliverance, runs from slavery through the outbreak of the Civil War, the emancipation of the slaves, and the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, to the present moment of Reconstruction. Reconstruction is here figured by African American voters, and they are shown to be inadequate. Indeed, the poem devotes 11 full stanzas to cataloging men who have sold their votes for rations, for meat and flour, for three sticks of candy, for a barrel of sugar that proves to be almost entirely filled by sand. At the end of this catalog, Aunt Chloe insists that she does not want to say that all our men are shabby, but that any flock of sheep contains one that's scabby. But the ratio her poem has offered is rather the reverse. After naming four men who sold their votes, she names only one who refused to do so. The figure of the unworthy male voter implicitly argues for female participation in electoral politics. The incapacity of the men opens up a space for their wives to intervene, and the poem depicts these wives as energetically engaged in democratic deliberation. They are adamant that their husbands vote for the Republicans, viewing a vote for the Democrats as tantamount to a vote for slavery, and they have strategies for ensuring that their husbands vote as they wish. So the man who sells his vote for flour and meat sees his wife throw them both out of the cabin, while the man who sells his vote for rations is forced by his wife to return them home. Yet another man is simply nagged into voting the right way. It is hardly surprising, given all this, that the women are said to have swung the election. Indeed, Aunt Chloe quotes a Democratic leader as saying, "His side had won the day, had not we women radicals just got right in the way." In this way, depicting unworthy male voters enables Harper to imagine worthy female voters. Depicting a corrupted political sphere enables Harper to advocate the continued need for reformers, and thereby doubly to show, as Minnie had claimed, that government needs a woman's conscience to guide a man's judgment. So it was almost immediately after Harper published the Aunt Chloe poems that the public discourses surrounding Reconstruction dramatically changed in the ways I just outlined. Suddenly, Harper's reformist criticisms of Reconstruction were echoed by Reconstruction's most virulently racist enemies, and these racist attacks would continue and intensify over the next 20 years. And so we would expect that when Harper returned to fiction with her 1892 novel Iola LeRoy, she would offer a new account of the period. She certainly acknowledges the need for one when she describes the symbolic power of the African-American officeholder. We first meet this officeholder when he is still a slave, brave enough to escape to the approaching Union Army, but loyal enough to stay in slavery in order to remain with his mother. In the middle of the novel, we learn that he has since become a member of the U.S. Congress, but now he sees him only through his neighbor's eyes, quite literally through their eyes when one of his neighbors travels all the way to Washington just in order to see him. And then it comes in dialect. I can't do dialect, so I'll just say, "And it did my old eyes good just to see it," the neighbor says. "If I couldn't go there myself, I was mighty glad to see that one of my people that could." But while Harper acknowledges the power of the exemplary figure, she refuses to create any more, a striking omission in a novel that is otherwise dedicated to idealizing the race. The novel is filled with brilliant doctors, noble teachers, self-sacrificing soldiers. Indeed, on the contrary, Iola Leroy repeats Harper's Reconstruction era works to an astonishing degree. It tells almost the same story of racial choosing that Minnie Sacrifice had done. Iola Leroy is a mixed race woman who had been raised as a planter's daughter and who learns that she is a slave only when she is sold after her father's death. And the plot follows her adventures of her and her brother as they struggle to find their mother and reunite their family in the aftermath of the war. But at the same time, Iola Leroy also presents the same folk characters that we had met in Sketches from the South, with the role of Aunt Chloe now being played by Aunt Linda. That Iola Leroy repeats the Reconstruction era works in form is not as surprising as the fact that the novel also repeats them in ideological content. To be sure, Harper does add the one exemplary African-American officeholder, but she quickly counters him with another officeholder far less inspiring. Notorious in slavery for his laziness and shiftlessness, this man goes into politics as the easiest way of making money without working. For the rest, Aunt Linda voices precisely the same criticisms that Aunt Chloe had made in precisely the same words. She reiterates the old catalog of bribes, for instance, complaining about a man who sold his meat vote for flour and meat, and another who sold it for what proved what looked to be a barrel of sugar. She also repeats the old complaint about voters selling their votes for almost nothing, adding this time the new detail that politics are now slinging that liquor around election times. In Iola Leroy, then, Harper simply repeats the criticisms of Reconstruction she had made while Reconstruction was ongoing, as if it had not since come to a violent and heartbreaking end. Indeed, the novel has trouble acknowledging that end. It moves through the antebellum period, the Civil War, and into Reconstruction quite straightforwardly, with markers of time appearing quite regularly, but then it jumps from what seems to be the early 1870s to what seems to be the early 1890s without any explanation. The characters haven't gotten any older, their stories have advanced only by a few months, but suddenly they are no longer holding office and setting up freedmen schools. They're instead lamenting the rise of segregation and the fact that African Americans are denied rights conferred on other groups. Among them, in these are the two key markers of 1890s discourse, among them dynamite-throwing terrorists and polygamous Mormons. This chronological awkwardness is of a piece with other formal lapses in the novel. Harper has trouble also moving between the novel's several plots. But it also reflects, I would argue, Harper's real difficulty in responding to the end of Reconstruction, a difficulty that the authors who follow her would also share. So now we come to Charles Chestnut. Charles Chestnut's early life was powerfully shaped by Reconstruction. His parents, both free persons of color, had left North Carolina for Ohio in the mid-1850s, but they returned after the war had ended, believing that there would be more possibility for them in the reconstructed southern states. And indeed, Chestnut's father would serve as Justice of the Peace and town commissioner during the Reconstruction years, as well as organizing his neighbors to build a freedmen's school. Chestnut himself came of age in the late 1870s, just as the last southern states were being redeemed, but he did not experience the end of Reconstruction as a decisive break. On the contrary, he thought of redemption as a necessary corrective to a radical program that had perhaps come just a bit too soon. We can see this in one of his earliest speeches entitled The Future of the Negro, and here he offers a very familiar redemptionist account of Reconstruction. We received the ballot, we became citizens, more than that, we became rulers. The bottom rail had gone on top, and for a while, we had a fine time. Then we lost our power, the bottom rail found its place again, and is likely to stay at the bottom until it becomes fit to go on top. So Chestnut can adopt the redemptionist tropes that had brought about the end of Reconstruction, the trope of inadequate black office holding, because he was certain that something like Reconstruction would soon return. We find this presumption, for instance, in a rather surprising place. In Chestnut's earliest published speech, which is entitled On the Advantages of a Well-Conducted Literary Society. Listing the benefits that a well-conducted literary society can confer, Chestnut identifies as chief among them training in governance. A literary society, he observes, provides practice at parliamentary procedures, which is necessary because every intelligent citizen is likely, almost certain, to be called upon at some time to take part in a public meeting or fill some public office under the present system of government. So there's a real confidence in the 1880s that he will soon be called to fill a public office. By the early 1890s, however, as Restoration began, Chestnut began to lose that confidence. He publishes an essay that describes the which laments the disfranchisement of African American voters through the Restoration Campaign, and he complains that the federal government is refusing to intervene. And this worsening conditions prompt him to offer a far stronger celebration of Reconstruction than he had offered a decade before. During those brief years, the country was free, and men in the South were equal before the law. They never were before, and they never have been since, and they will not be in this generation unless the strong outstretched arm of the government is invoked to compel the execution of the law. Chestnut had been willing a decade earlier to conform to the redemptionist account of Reconstruction's end, but now he challenges that account. He defends the Reconstruction-era state governments as far more able than the democratic governments that had followed them. He points out the corruption that has since taken place in the southern states. And he defends the African-American officeholder specifically from attack, exposing the political uses to which the figure of the officeholder has been put. He observes that the supporters of disfranchisement are misrepresenting the Reconstruction era and Haiti after the revolution as well, in order to imply that African American men are unprepared for public life. That same year, 1899, Chestnut published two collections of short stories. And in one of those short stories, he offers a depiction of African-American officeholding that does accord with his non-fictional arguments. This is a comedy of manners entitled A Matter of Principle that describes the stir that is caused in an Ohio town when an eligible young African-American congressman pays a visit. Now, the point of the story is to satirize race prejudice, because the parents of the daughters in the town don't want their daughter to be courted by this man until they know what color his skin is. But the story captures, however, a moment, a post-redemption moment, where at least in the North, at least in some sectors of the South, African-American voters remain politically powerful, so much so that they hold a parallel inaugural ball to celebrate the role they played in electing the new president. And the congressman has power as well. Welcomed by African-American parents as an eligible suitor for their daughters, he is welcomed just as eagerly by white businessmen as a member of the Special Congressional Subcommittee on Public Works. But while Chestnut can defend Reconstruction-era officeholders in his nonfictional writings and depict post-Reconstruction officeholders favorably in his fiction works fail to depict officeholders during Reconstruction. Indeed, his fictional works have trouble depicting Reconstruction at all. The Conjure Tales, for instance, are set rather vaguely, with the narrator saying only that sufficient time has passed since the Civil War for conditions in the southern states to have become somewhat settled. Left unclear is whether those conditions were settled by Reconstruction or by the subsequent redemption of the states to democratic rule. The House Behind the Cedars is more explicitly set during Reconstruction. The action takes place a few years after the Civil War, and references made to loyalty oaths and freedmen schools, while the white characters complain about the bottom rail having come on top. But the fact of Reconstruction ends up making little difference in the novel's plot. To be sure, the novel describes remarkable social transformations. One of its two mixed-race protagonists has become a prosperous lawyer and planter since the war. This is made possible, however, not by the new political order established by Reconstruction, but rather by the protagonist's decision to pass as white. Oh, no. Okay. But if Reconstruction can be obscured, it cannot be forgotten. In The House Behind the Cedars, it returns enfolded in traumatic memory. When the novel's protagonist returns home at the end of the Civil War, he notes the changes that have taken place. Only one of the changes can be attributed to Reconstruction. He sees a colored policeman in the old constable's place, and he reflects that this was a stronger reminder than even the burned buildings of all the changes that had taken place. As the protagonist muses on white constables and African-American policemen, a memory of violence intrudes. He recalls a lynching he had witnessed as a child, a memory that in turn prompts the novel's readers to recall both the lynchings of the late 1860s of the novel's setting and of the late 1890s of the novel's writing. This is the only mention the novel makes of lynching and the only mention it makes of any kind of public office being held by any kind of African-American man. The two appear together and are forgotten together as well. And in The Marrow of Tradition, Chestnut's greatest novel, Reconstruction returns as mere plot device that ends up exerting a powerful force on events. The novel explicitly concerns itself with the very recent past, with the Wilmington massacres of 1898, the most violent of the insurgencies that drove the remaining African-American legislators from office during Restoration, and the remaining African-American voters from the polls. The novel offers a fictionalized account of the massacre and encloses that account within the story of a family. The novel is organized around two central characters, Major Carteret, a white newspaper editor from the planter class who rouses and directs the insurgency, and Dr. Miller, an African-American doctor who tries to avoid all political involvements and simply do good for his race. The two men are related by marriage. The editor